Analysis with Travis Wingfield and Kevin Dern. Brought to you by WelcomeToPerfectville.com. Prepare to go deep.
Hello, Dol fans, and welcome to the first inaugural episode of the Finalysis podcast associated with Perfectville. My name is Travis Wingfield. You may recognize me from Right Travis Right with Perfectville. And what the idea behind this podcast is trying to go a little further in depth to the film study and behind the coach's film for the Miami Dolphins football games. And I will be covering the offensive portion of the game film, and joining me for the defense will be one of my favorite Dolphins fans I've had the pleasure of encountering over the last decade plus or so. He's a mainstay at thefins.com. His name is Kevin. You may know him as Ronan on the forums. And I will let Kevin introduce himself.
Yeah, my name is Kevin Dern. I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, and really excited to do this. I'm glad that Travis reached out. One of the things we were talking about was what made us become a Fins fan, and I'll share a quick story of how I became a fan. I remember in second grade, every boy in my class had the Dallas Cowboys starter jacket. You know, if you grew up in that era, you had that jacket and knew Emmitt Smith and Michael Irvin and Troy Aikman and all those guys. And even my mom bought me the Dallas Cowboys starter jacket just to help fit in and make friends. And I remember the first game I ever watched was when Miami upset Dallas in the snow on Thanksgiving. And a couple weeks later, we had a snow day already scheduled for Tuesday, and my dad let me stay up and watch them on Monday night. And they got crushed by San Diego, but that kind of hooked me in as a fan. And then I didn't even realize who Dan Marino was until the next year. He came back week one, and they had that epic shootout. Miami ended up beating the Patriots with Drew Bledsoe in week one. And I've been hooked as a fan ever since, even though I've been in Bengal country the whole time.
Those are great stories, man. I have so many parallels to all those. The starter jacket, I had the exact same thing. My brother actually had it and gave it to me as a hand-me-down. And I was like 5 years old, so naturally I wanted to do anything he wanted to do, so I took that and ran with it. The game that I actually recall most in terms of hooking me was also a loss to the Chargers. The Stojanovic missed field goal, and I want to say that was 94.
Yep, Natron Means ran over the referee and stepped out of bounds, and they didn't replay it that year, so.
Why would they, right?
I remember that one.
Exactly. So, yeah, that game, and then I remember the 94 Marino-Bledsoe game as well. I actually have that on VHS tape, believe it or not.
That's a Finn's treasure right there.
Yeah, we don't have many in the last few years, so we have to go back to the old VCR days. So, anyway, yep. What me and Kevin want to do, like I said earlier, is we want to go over the All-22 Coaches film on the Game Pass on NFL.com. and kind of break down what's going on with these Dolphins. It's the best way you can get a look at how the game plays out in terms of what the coaches see and what the players evaluate when they do their meetings on, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, throughout the entire week. So, you know, we're not as entertaining as Chris and Sam. We're not trying to be. We're a little more nerdy. We push our glasses up on top of our nose and do that whole thing. So I'm going to kick it off with the defense first and let Kevin get into his specialty. Kevin, this episode is going to be kind of recapping the first four games of the season, the quarter pole, if you will. And Kevin, what are some of the good things you've noticed with this defense so far?
As far as the defense, you know, I think, you know, having the opportunity to sit where I sat, I was at the Bengals game on Thursday night in person. I guess that's sort of an unfortunate thing. But the cool part was I got to sit in the end zone closest to where most of the action happened. And you know, Ndamukong Suh, to me, he's worth every penny of that $114 million that Miami gave him. Just watching him, you know, in that game and all three of the other games, he gets doubled on probably 80 to 90% of the plays. And, you know, he's still out there making play after play or freeing up guys off blocks. And, you know, just one of the things that was kind of unique about the Bengals game is the Bengals, just because they're still trying to bring along Tyler Boyd, you know, Brandon LaFell's kind of limited outside, and Tyler Eifert was still inactive, is they ran base personnel a good bit of the time. I haven't gotten a chance to go back and watch all of the game film on it to give you a snap count or a percentage of it, but, you know, Miami played more base defense in that game than they have in the other three games combined, probably. And just seeing the amount of plays that Ndamukong Suh makes for other guys. You know, he occupies blockers. You know, I thought Jason Jones had by far and away his best game. Kiko Alonso probably the same. He was able to kind of roam sideline to sideline, and he made a lot of plays out wide on the perimeter. So I would just say, you know, Ndamukong Suh doing what he does best has been a constant. that's probably the number one thing. Right behind him, and I would almost call it 1B, would be Rashad Jones. You know, whether he's in the box or whether he's deep in a single high safety look, he's pretty much everywhere. One of the things I thought was kind of different was he seemed, at least from my perspective watching that Bengals game, to be playing, you know, as sort of the true center field free safety type a lot more than he had in the other games. And what's amazing to me is just how fast he can come down and get into the hook zone or into the flat and make a tackle. You know, he had a really good ball game in that game, and I think he graded out, you know, Pro Football Focus as the highest graded defender for Miami in that game, and I believe it. Some of the other positives I've had would be Xavien Howard. You know, he's a second-round rookie that came in. He got hurt in the last practice of OTAs, and he basically had no training camp. You know, he got that final week and the fourth preseason game against, you know, most of the Titans backups. And there he is out there starting week one in Seattle on the road. And even Seattle and Russell Wilson tried to pick on him a little bit early, and he held his own. He almost had the interception in the Cleveland game. I thought he did pretty well against A.J. Green. You know, he gave up the one long pass, but, you know, I think, you know, it's kind of a bang-bang play. They could have called offensive pass interference on A.J. Green for the push-off. They also probably could have got Xavien Howard for illegal contact before they ever got down the field. But other than that, I've been pretty impressed with him, and he's certainly not afraid to come up and stick his nose in and help out and run support, which, unfortunately, pretty much no matter who's been on the other side opposite him, whether it's been Byron Maxwell or even Bobby McCain's had a few snaps out there, and Tony Lippett, all three of those guys, you know, have really struggled in that regard. McCain's done better when he's in the slot, which has been kind of a pleasant surprise. You know, he kind of didn't really have that full grasp on that role week one against Seattle and even week two against New England, but he's kind of grown into it. And, you know, in terms of the secondary, he was probably the best player we had, not named Rashad Jones, against the Bengals. And I've even seen a few posters on the Fins kind of suggest, you know, maybe you start him out wide. I've been really impressed with his play, at least for the last 2 weeks. And probably the last guy I would say that's really impressed me, and I kind of thought he would, I didn't think he'd be as good as he is, but that would be Jason Jones. He's basically played in this defense the longest out of any player on the Dolphins other than Sue. You know, he came over from Detroit in that wide nine style. And, you know, he's been a career left end for them. Miami's asking him to play the right side because of Mario Williams and Cameron Wake. And I thought he did very well in the Seattle game. He struggled a little bit late in the Patriots game when LeGarrette Blount kind of hit some of those sweep plays to the outside. And, you know, Miami couldn't get off the field to give the offense more time to come down and try and tie that game at the end. But I thought he played really well against Cleveland, especially for having to go up against Joe Thomas pretty much the whole night. And against Cincinnati, Andrew Whitworth, you know, has been a pretty good left tackle, and I've probably seen him a little bit more than most living in Cincinnati. He's not that far off from Joe Thomas in terms of pass blocking. And I thought Jason Jones, you know, while he didn't get many pressures, he was all over the field making stops in the run game. He played down the line very well. He got pretty good leverage a lot of times. I think really the only plays that he kind of slipped up on were when the Bengals ran that sort of unbalanced line when they put Whitworth over at right tight end and then had just a guard to that side, and they kind of ran an iso play with Jones, and I think it was Donald Butler for the most part. Jeremy Hill had two big runs. I think there was a 19-yarder and like a 14 or 15-yarder both to that side where Jones, you know, basically read the play inside, and Butler had an open window read to the outside, and Hill just juked him out of his socks both times. Yeah. But those guys would get my, you know, thumbs up awards through the first four games. You know, right behind that, I'd probably say Mario Williams. He hasn't been as consistent as I thought he'd be in terms of pass rushing, but he's been a little bit better of a run stopper than I thought going in, especially after what you saw last year in Buffalo when they kind of had to play him as a 3-4 outside backer. And then Jordan Phillips has shown a few flash plays. You know, there was the one play in Seattle week one where he basically tackled the guard, Russell Wilson, and caused a fumble all on the same play. That was a huge play at the time. I think if he can just get more consistent throughout the year, he's going to end up in that plus category towards the end of the season.
Yeah, and I was there for that Seattle game live in person. Kevin mentioned he's from Cincinnati. I reside in the Seattle area, or close to it at least, and I was there to see Jordan Phillips make that play in the backfield. And it was something to behold. You know, he's a big man. His pass rushing has really come along. I'd like to see his run defense improve a little bit. Do you think that's something maybe he can gain as he goes along, or is he just not going to be a very good run defender?
Yeah, I think part of the problem, just having watched him, and he went up against Clint Bowling and Russell Bodine most of the night against Cincinnati. For those that really haven't seen a lot of the Bengals play, Clint Bowling's one of the better left guards in the league. And, you know, that's a challenge to go up against him one-on-one. I think the biggest issue that Jordan Phillips has is his conditioning. You know, if he's out on the field for 4 or 5-plus plays in a drive and Miami can't get off the field, he gets tired. And Miami, with Earl Mitchell being on IR for the time being, or, you know, maybe he's played his last snap, who knows. But they really don't have a big body behind Jordan Phillips to come in and kind of eat some of those double teams. And I think he's had to play more than Miami would probably like. And I think he just kind of, you know, loses some steam the more he plays. The other issue, sort of a technical issue he has, is he's 6'6". He's a big, tall, long guy. He needs to learn to play with leverage more consistently. And, you know, he kind of reminds me of Terrence Knighton. You know, everyone remembers him from the Denver Broncos. They had a pretty good defense that year when they ended up losing to Seattle in the Super Bowl. But not many people remember Terrence Knighton when he started out his career in Jacksonville. You know, he couldn't figure out hand placement. He couldn't figure out his pad level. I see some of those same things in Jordan Phillips, and I think some of that stems with having to play in the Big 12 conference when he was in college at Oklahoma. It's just all those quick spread teams, you know, where he'd never really had to learn how to play against a combo block or stop a trap or stop a power play right at him, because all those teams just throw the ball all day. And I think that's something that'll come with time, and obviously Jim Washburn, I think, will play a big part in that. But I think it would behoove Miami to get someone, you know, maybe other than Earl Mitchell, who can come in and kind of take some of those snaps. Julius Wormsley looks like a nice player that they found, but I think he's more of a true three technique. And then Chris Jones, I don't know if he's a great fit for this defense, but he's probably the best you can get off the street right now, and he had to come in and fill in for Earl Mitchell. But neither of those guys are really that big body type that can come in and help eat a few more snaps and keep Jordan Phillips rested. And then obviously the other factor in that too is the offense. I think they're dead last in time of possession through four games. And I think that, you know, if the offense could consistently stay on the field, that would help Phillips and the defense as a whole, just keeping them more fresh throughout the game.
Well, and you really transitioned well into my next point for the offensive side, because the guys they go up against every day in practice, the offensive line. You know, I wrote a piece earlier this year on Perfectville, my season preview, talking about how the upgraded pass protection would be what really set this team apart from, you know, previous years under Joe Philbin and Bill Lazor and Mike Sherman and all those wonderful coordinators we've had. And that, you know, the guy that I really have enjoyed watching so far has been Laremy Tunsil on the offensive line. You know, obviously a high first round draft choice, slid in the draft a little bit because of the whole bong mask thing, but he's just been everything I thought he would be and more so far this season. He played really well at left tackle last game against the Bengals. I thought he was
totally agree.
Wasn't he awesome out there? I mean, at what point do you say, okay, you know, Mr. Brandon Albert, do you kick him inside to guard? Because Tunsil played so well on the perimeter, and he just looks so much more natural out there. I saw him get a seal block on a run where he ran a little, I don't know if you call it a pull, because I don't know if you consider tackles pulling, but he kind of pulled out to the left and sealed the edge there for, I think it was Isaiah Peter on the edge, and it looked like a really good just technique and form and everything on his part. But the pass protection across the offensive line has really struggled, at least in the last game. But the two games before that, they allowed, I want to say it was one sack between the two games, or maybe two sacks in the two games.
Yeah, I think it was just that one against Cleveland at the end of the game.
The strip.
When Tannehill got stripped, yeah.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, so I was expecting this group to really lead the way in pass protection, and they have been, and, you know, they weren't healthy in the last game, so I'm kind of looking forward to them getting back to full strength and full health and protecting Tannehill again, because we know how much he struggles to go off script and make plays from that way. But the group that was really impressive to me so far on the offensive side has been the receivers, which is funny because the Bengals game, I thought they were pretty awful all around the board. I don't know if you want to call it coaching or scheming or whatever, but they were running routes and not getting open. They were masked and covered the entire day. But you got to take advantage of Jarvis Landry and Devontae Parker at some point, because they both offer such unique differences in their skill set, and you'd even throw Kenny Stills in there too. You know, Landry likes to make his hay around the line of scrimmage. You know, he's a running back on steroids, basically, as a receiver. He catches a lot of passes near the line of scrimmage, breaks a lot of tackles. I am getting a little sick of his going backwards routine, but it does result in the big play here and there. Devontae Parker, the way he can set up his own routes is textbook, and I've made comparisons from him to AJ Green and Calvin Johnson in the past. The way he sets up his routes, because he understands leverage as well as anybody. And you know, a lot of people wonder what makes a receiver good. They want to see these great hands. They want to see some high end speed, and can they jump? Well, those are all fine and dandy, but if you can't play the position, it doesn't do any good. And I see a lot of natural abilities out of him where he bends routes to the outside, cuts them back to the inside, sets his defender up, and he uses body positioning so well in terms of putting his body between it, hit the ball and the defender, and using his hands to hand catch the football. And it puts him in a position to make a lot of big plays, and they've used it a couple times in the two games in the middle, the Patriots and the Cleveland game. The first game he was unfortunately inactive up in Seattle, and then last game he didn't do squat the entire game, so that was sad to see. But those are my two bright spots for the offense, along with Laremy Tunsil. Kenny Stills is capable of taking the top off of defense. We know that. We've seen that. He did it twice.
He's one for two.
I was just going to say, he's batting 500 on the old long ball there. You know, Tannehill's criticism in the past few years has been he hasn't been able to throw the long ball, but he's doing just fine on that regard. So those guys, I like what I've seen from Kenyon Drake so far. I don't like how little I've seen Kenyon Drake so far. Last game, he had two carries for 15 yards, and that's 7.5 yards of carry. I know it's just two carries, but mistakes be damned. You put him on the bench. You know, I know Adam Gase's whole theory has been, if you don't perform, you're not going to play. Well, some of these guys are young. This team is very young and still learning in a lot of positions, and they need to get out there on the field. So those would be my bright spots for the offense so far. I got plenty more bad points to get to on the offense, but before I do that, I'll let you get to your thumbs down, if you will, on the defense. Who's been really disappointing to you so far?
Gotcha. Well, before I get to that, I gotta piggyback on Laremy Tunsil real quick. Just sitting where I sat in the game in the end zone gives you kind of a really good view of the offensive line. And there was just one play in particular. I believe it was the first drive Miami had the ball in the second quarter. And Michael Johnson, the Bengals right end, got, you know, probably a pretty good step and a half jump on Tunsil. And I was watching it on the Jumbotron because they were coming at us in the end zone. And, you know, I was like, oh, crap, he's about to get sacked. And Tunsil's feet are just amazingly good. He was able to take two steps and redirect, and he ended up pushing Michael Johnson right past Tannehill, which was probably a good thing because Tannehill only took kind of a half step up in the pocket. But just seeing his feet, you know, I would have a hard time putting him back at left guard when Albert's back from, I think he had an illness issue today. His feet are just so good. You know, I feel he's our left tackle for the next 10 years.
Can I cut you off real quick, Kevin? I don't understand why they don't want to go back to that plan, because you have Brandon Albert here, who played guard and a little bit of guard in college. He was drafted as a guard before getting kicked out to tackle in Kansas City. And Tunsil has been a career tackle. So, and you look at the Ole Miss splits from when Tunsil's in the game, when he's not in the game. He made that offense go, and I know it's funny to say for an offensive lineman, but the stats really showed that him being a lineup made them a much better team. And
I think part of it's just got to be the salary and probably some veteran pride in Brandon Albert not wanting to lose that left tackle spot.
You know, but if Byron Maxwell's liable to be benched and these guys are liable to be benched, then I think we're going to have to get over that, because you got to put the best team on the field. It sends a message to the team that, you know, we're putting the best 11 out there. And Laremy Tunsil, like you said, his footwork would make, you know, Rex Ryan around, if you will.
There had to be a Rex Ryan joke in there somewhere.
I got to try, man. I got to take my swings. But I'll let you get back to the defense, and I'll leave my stupid jokes to the side.
It'll definitely be interesting to see what the actual starting lineup looks like when they play Tennessee on Sunday. Jumping into some of the kind of less bright spots on the defense so far, there's really two that kind of stand out to me just in terms of personnel. The first one, I think, is kind of the obvious one. It's Byron Maxwell. You know, when Miami made that trade to move out of the eighth overall pick, everyone kind of assumed, you know, Maxwell was the key prize in that trade, and Kiko Alonso was just kind of tossed in. The performance on the field, while not great, it's been the opposite. You know, Maxwell, he got burned by Doug Baldwin countless times in that Seattle game, including that big fourth down conversion they had on the final drive to go for the touchdown. You know, Terrell Pryor basically burst onto the national scene, you know, media-wise by torching Byron Maxwell all game. They finally let Maxwell press towards the end of the game, and he made two nice stops. And whatever transpired between that and Thursday night that got him benched, you know, we'll probably never know. But, you know, I think overall, through the first three games that he played, you know, there's a handful of really good snaps, and most of it was pretty bad. And he made some Brent Grimes business decisions trying to stop LeGarrette Blount in that Patriots game. That kind of left a sour taste in my mouth. And, you know, I applaud Adam Gase for, you know, benching a guy who's making the type of salary that Maxwell is. I'll kind of jump back to the cornerback play in a second, because that's one of my other down, you know, thumbs down spots. But number two, I would have to say, is Jelani Jenkins. The defense played probably their best game of the season, arguably against the Bengals. Maybe you can say that Seattle game was just as good, but Jelani Jenkins not being out there, I thought, helped him. In my opinion, Donald Butler probably needs to be the third starter with Misi and Alonso moving forward. You know, Jenkins, I really don't know what to say. You know, he came in that first game of 2014 after Danelle Ellerbe went down against the Patriots, played really well for 12 or 13 games. I know he missed a couple due to injury at the end of the year. Last year, he kind of had nagging injuries all year, but this year, he's just been awful. He's been false-keyed too many times. I know the Browns game, there were quite a few times where Cody Kessler, you know, and even Terrell Pryor, for that matter, would do that zone read play where they pull it back real quick and they fire a quick slant. Well, Jelani Jenkins is supposed to be in that hook curl zone to kind of interfere with that route, especially when the corner to that side, which I think was Maxwell at least twice, wasn't playing press. He was playing off. You know, it's that linebacker's responsibility to drop and get depth and be in that zone. And both times, Jelani Jenkins bit hard on the play fake, and he's basically covering no one, because I think it was Isaiah Correll both times stating to help block Cameron Wake across the formation, and Maxwell just leaves a big gap right there. And that kind of segues into my third point is, this was kind of one of my surprising things, is knowing what we know about this scheme and hearing all the talk from Vance Joseph and Adam Gase coming into training camp and through OTAs and all that, they talked about being a press team. We really haven't seen that. And, you know, that's kind of one of the things that, you know, bothered me coming out of that Bengals game. You know, AJ Green is hands down going to be faster off the ball and up the field than both Xavier Howard and Tony Lippett out on the perimeter. And, you know, I think Green had a long catch, like 30-some, 40-some yards against Tony Lippett down the left sideline. Lippett doesn't even try and reroute him at the line of scrimmage, and Green just blows by him out of pure foot speed. I don't think Lippett ever even got a hand on him. That's one thing that surprised me. I thought we would kind of play corners on the perimeter, sort of like Seattle does with Richard Sherman, just kind of coming up, pressing you, trying to reroute you, and getting you off your route. We really haven't seen that a whole lot, other than except from Byron Maxwell on a couple slant plays in the Cleveland game. And then the other thing that kind of bothered me, especially knowing how good of a coach I think Vance Joseph is he got completely outfoxed by Josh McDaniels and the Patriots, at least for the first quarter and a half of that game in New England. You know, countless times he left Kiko Alonso and Jelani Jenkins man-on-man or in middle zones against guys like, you know, Chris Hogan, Danny Amendola, Julian Edelman. Jenkins and Alonso, they're fast as far as linebackers go, but they shouldn't be left in those situations. And, you know, Vance Joseph wasn't able to adjust until it was already 21-0. And, you know, that kind of sank us. You know, the offense came back in the second half pretty strong, but you know, you can't just let yourself get down 21-0, especially when, you know, at least through four games, Miami's offense has shown a propensity to start really slow on that side of the ball. So Vance Joseph, I'm pretty neutral on him. I think he's called two terrific ball games against Seattle and Cincinnati. You know, Miami gave up 5 field goals against the Bengals, and they got no help from the offense. The Cleveland game, I think, is kind of a tough thing because you don't really know what Hugh Jackson's going to do week to week. And then Terrell Pryor came in, and I just don't think Miami was really ready schematically for that. You know, the Patriots game, you know, 2.5 quarters of it were pretty solid other than that final drive in the fourth quarter. But the first quarter and a half were awful. You know, even Kevin Coyle came up with some better game plans to kind of slow down that Patriots short passing game. I don't think Vance Joseph will be fooled again by that when we see the Patriots again, or even if we see a similar offense like that. You know, maybe San Diego with Phillip Rivers coming up after this 4-game home stretch. But those would be my thumbs downs so far this year. I'm kind of neutral on a few players, but, you know, Travis, if you want to jump in and touch on the offense,
yeah,
go ahead.
I didn't mean to cut you off there. It leads perfectly into my point about, you know, my thumbs down for this team because, you know, the big difference in the team I thought this year was going to be the coaching staff. And we have similar talent across the board. You know, you can trade out a few guys here and there, Olivier Vernon from Mario Williams, but that's kind of been a wash at this point. If you look at the production in terms of pass rushing from those two players, I mean, coaching was supposed to be what made this team a lot better, and I just haven't seen it so far. You know, you already mentioned Vance Joseph, but it goes to the offense as well because the plan has just been muddied and convoluted over the first 4 games for the offense. You know, I look at Adam Gase's offense in Chicago and in Denver, and he has these route concepts where he attacks different levels of the field. He runs one route to decoy to set up another route, and he opens up the offense and spreads the defense and attacks all levels vertically and horizontally. And I haven't seen that so far in Miami. The first game, it was super conservative, you know, a lot of short play calls underneath. And he even said before he took this job or right around the time the season started was that this league is played within 10 yards of the line of scrimmage. And that's fine. That's okay if you're doing that, as long as you're efficient at doing it. But it didn't work in Seattle. So they scrapped the plan and then they go to a more, you know, let Ryan Tannehill kind of get his feel for the game and do the things he's wanting to do. And they go and score the go-ahead touchdown, which they ended up giving up back to the defense on the other side, but that's besides the point. Same thing in New England, you know, start slow, and then they start kind of chucking a little bit with some, it almost looked automatic with some 15-yard in cuts and hitches they were running that were just easy first downs and chunk yardage here at, you know, 15 yards at a time. And then there was that portion of the Cleveland game where did the same thing, but he got so enamored with running the ball on first and second down, you know, second and 10 runs that were going for 2 yards were behind schedule and behind the chain so often that the offense is going 3 and out too often. They scored 30 points, and it took them overtime to get 30 points, but that game just didn't feel as dominant as the score would suggest in terms of scoring 30 points. And then the Cincinnati game, I don't really got to tell you about that one. You were there, you saw it. The plan was just, I didn't like the plan because you're down, you know, the left tackle, you're down the center, you're down the backup center, and your right tackle's playing like crap, and you're running these slow-developing routes that are taking 4 and 5 seconds to develop, and by the time Ryan Tannehill lets the ball go, or is ready to let the ball go, or has to let the ball go, the receivers have their backs turned to him still. So Adam Gase's offensive plan has just been muddied and not, it hasn't looked good so far. That's my biggest down, thumbs down on the offense thus far.
Travis, let me jump in. I have to ask you a question. So after the Cleveland game, and this relates to your point about the offense, I've got a real good buddy who's a Packers fan. So obviously he's pretty spoiled getting to watch Aaron Rodgers week in and week out. His wife, unfortunately, is a Browns fan, so they actually watched that game on TV. And he sent me an email at halftime saying, you know, Kevin, does it seem like the Dolphins' offense is just almost over-designed? You know, he compared it to, and if you're a historical buff, you may get this reference, otherwise you're just going to think I'm a big nerd, but he compared it to the German Tiger tank in World War II. You know, it was the best tank out there, but it was so hard to maintain in the field, the Germans couldn't really use it to the full effect, and they ended up, you know, losing the war, obviously. But, you know, you've seen all the games. I think you said you've had a chance to review them all on Game Pass. You know, does it make sense to say that, you know, some of those passing concepts are more tailored to, like, the Peyton Manning level of the offense? You know, obviously there's the tie-in with Clyde Christensen, and that they're not really suited to Ryan Tannehill. Like, do you get that sense that some of the plays are almost you know, at the doctorate level rather than Tannehill, who's probably still at the sophomore junior level of running offense.
I can definitely see that, and that's a good point, because I think it was the Atlanta preseason game when they mentioned that Peyton Manning ran this offense at a PhD level, and Ryan Tannehill's only recently just got his high school diploma in it. So, you know, 4 weeks into it, it takes some time to develop. You know, Bruce Arians famously said it takes 8 weeks to grasp an offense, at least at even a novice level. I think Ryan Tannehill has too much things going on in his head right now. You know, he's working on getting the play calls, the protections called, the route concepts. He looks like a confused quarterback back there. Like, he's not trusting.
And obviously not having Pouncey probably hurts things as far as getting some of the protections right, too.
Yeah, I mean, his center came out and said, you guys are pranking me, right? And they told me he was going to play center. So it just looks like there's too much going on for him right now. I think it'll slow down. My big gripe on his game so far, the quarterback that is, has been his timing on plays. He's not anticipating. And I've seen him anticipate before, so it makes me wonder if this is something that is just a function of learning the new offense. I don't think it's something he can't do. I think he will do it in the future. So, yeah, to kind of answer your question, I think he just needs some more time. People want to panic 4 games in, and that's understandable. You know, 1-3 is not fun for anybody. But, you know, 3 tough road games in September, a short week for a rookie head coach with a banged-up roster. That game was pretty much going into a buzzsaw. So
yeah, I think most people outside of the Miami fan base would look at that schedule and think Miami was going to go 1-3, you know, no matter who our coach was or what the offense was. That's just a brutal start.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, when you get the injuries in the inside line and the inside of the line, too, like you said with Anthony Steen playing, Jermon Bushrod's not been great. His run blocking was never good. His pass pro has been not great either. Billy Turner, I like the talent there, but there seems to be some kind of coaching discrepancy because his footwork has been sloppy. His splits have been just confusing. Like, he's kind of going ankle to ankle with the center and the tackle. It's like, what is that? What are you trying to accomplish by that? So, yeah, my thumbs down would be the coaching, the interior line play, and then I got to say the quarterback play has not been great so far. But I think it'll come along as we go along. So let's get to our last segment here, man. I got some soon-to-be in-laws come over for dinner here shortly, so I want to get going on that. I don't want to, but I have to. So you got a couple surprises for me, right, on the defense. Who surprised you so far on this defense?
Yeah, I really kind of touched on the first surprise was sort of the lack of the bump-and-run play, you know, from the corners out wide. Yes,
absolutely.
That being said, for two of my surprises, I already mentioned Xavien Howard a little bit. I'd actually go with Bobby McCain, you know, I thought he was really good in the slot last year, and it seemed like kind of coming into the season, at least the first two games, he kind of lost a handle on that job full time. They had Michael Thomas kind of rotating in, you know, at least against New England, and then Vance Joseph kind of explained that. But I thought the last two games against Cleveland and Cincinnati, Bobby McCain's kind of taken ownership of that position. And I did notice that, you know, in the Cincinnati game, he played the slot pretty much exclusively, and they had Thomas rotating in for Issa Abdul-Kaddous in some of the packages. And, you know, IAQ, as I call him, is actually my number two surprise player.
Yes.
I hadn't really seen him play a whole lot. You know, my old roommate was a huge Detroit Lions fan, so we watched a couple games, you know, last year together, you know, when the Dolphins weren't playing. And he kind of jumped out on the screen a few times. I remember their game against New Orleans, and I was like, man, he's a pretty good player. And he goes, yeah, we'll probably lose him in free agency too. And sure enough, he came to Miami. I thought he's been pretty good. You know, he had the interception against Wilson in week one against Seattle. He's come up and he's played the run very well. A couple of the guys I follow on Twitter that were kind of keen on him as a signing said one of the things that jumps out is he takes pretty poor angles to the ball. I don't think we've seen that creep up as much as we thought. There was a couple plays against New England where he was kind of out of position, but I mean, you could say that for pretty much everyone on defense that game, except for Ndamukong Suh. You know, even Rashad Jones got caught peeking in the backfield a few times. But those are my two surprise players, and then just kind of as a whole, the 2016 rookie class. I mean, when was the last time we've had 5 rookies come in and had 3 of them start, or I guess 4 of them really kind of start ball games right off the bat? You know, Tunsil. Howard came in off the short training camp. Kenyon Drake, you know, I think he was inactive the first week, but you know, he started a game and I thought he's run pretty well. Carew had to start for Parker week one. And unfortunately, Jakeem Grant hasn't really got an opportunity to return a kick or a punt very much. But you know, I think we all kind of saw in the preseason what he could do, and I'm anxious to see how they, you know, kind of bring him along as the season progresses. But that's my final surprise, was just, you know, how well this rookie class has played starting off.
Well, it is nice to even just see rookies get on the field for us when Joe Philbin was like, putting him in a meat locker for the first 8 weeks of the season or so. Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that point. I'm a big fan of Xavien Howard. I'm a big fan of Tunzel, obviously. I think Drake is going to be a contributor for this team. And Leonte Carew, he had one route where he turned Sherman around, Richard Sherman around in Seattle. And I think that was his only catch, but it was a really nice route and something to look forward to. So my surprise players in the offense, you mentioned him earlier, was Kenyon Drake. I didn't expect him to get a lot of playing time because I thought Arian Foster would give us at least 4 games before the injury occurred. Unfortunately, he only gave us 1.25 games before that happened. But he's been surprising to me. And Jay Ajayi, in the way that he came back from adversity after the first 2 games, you know, he did the whole pouting thing and didn't get to come to Seattle. And then he had that fumble in the New England game, and that, you know, I was pretty much ready to send him home after that point. But he looks sharp in the Cincinnati game. He looks like he's running with a bit of authority and like an attitude that I didn't think we were going to see out of him this year. So, you know, you mentioned it earlier before we logged on that they're still averaging, all of them are averaging over 4 yards a carry, which that's something you wouldn't expect from the way this team run blocks. And then my my bad surprise has been Mr. Hairless himself, Juwan James. His first stretch of games as a rookie, he played pretty well before he got to slide over to left tackle and looked like crap out there. And then last year he had the injury too, and this year it's just been like, I don't know what he's doing out there, because there's plays where the snap gets off and he goes for a combo chip block or, you know, something, and he ends up standing there and just kind of looking for someone to block, and he doesn't do anything on the play. So, yeah, Juwan James.
Yeah, he's kind of crumbled before our eyes the last couple games, and I feel like we need to launch an investigation or call into the Feinbaum show or something. And what is it with the University of Tennessee getting all these guys with no eyebrows, like Josh Dobbs, their quarterback? You know, no eyebrows. Like, you can't be a good passer without eyebrows, in my opinion. But you know, obviously they're 5-0, but I think they've got Bama and Texas A&M, and then Bama on the horizon. So yeah, I'll be surprised if they're not 5-2 after a couple weeks. But you know, something must be going on in the Tennessee River down there.
Yeah, they'll probably come back to earth, and maybe they should ban the old Bunsen burner from their science programs down there. Right. That's the idea.
Yeah.
All right, Kevin. Well, let's wrap things up here. That was a great first episode, man. I had a good time doing it with you. You got anything else to add?
You know, I think you touched on it, and when you were talking about Tannehill, you know, I think hopefully the offense will kind of pick up, you know, as we get moving forward. You know, I think having that sort of mini bye week off the Thursday game will help. I didn't get a chance to listen to Adam Gase's press, you know, availability today, but I follow a couple of the beat writers on Twitter, and it sounds like he did a lot of self-scouting. So I'm anxious to see what happens, you know, against Tennessee, and, you know, just having a 4-game homestand, I feel like Miami's got to go 3-1 on this homestand to get to 4-4, you know, at the midway point to have a shot. And, you know, the season's not over yet, but I feel like they've got to go at least 2-2 or 3-1 to have a chance.
Yeah, at minimum 2-2, because if you go, that would put us, if we went 1-3, that would put us at, what, 2-6 at the halfway point?
Yep.
Yeah, that season's over at that point. I actually put together a spreadsheet of some draftable players today, so that kind of tells where I'm thinking the season's going. But
yeah, I was watching Davis Webb highlights at lunch, so I'm with you.
I'm with you there, too. So, all right, man, well, it was really good talking to you. We'll do it again shortly, and that should be it from the first episode of Finalysis. Hope you guys enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Finalysis with Travis Wingfield and Kevin Dern. Subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes, and go to welcometoperfectfield.com for the very best coverage of your Miami Dolphins. Fins up.